Welcome to Rethinking Wellness, a podcast and Substack newsletter that offers critical thinking and compassionate skepticism about wellness and diet culture and reflections on how to find true well-being. I'm your host, Christy Harrison. I'm a health journalist, a registered dietitian specializing in disordered eating, and the author of three books, including Anti-Diet, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, and The Wellness Trap, which was the inspiration for this podcast. If you like what you hear, become a paid subscriber to get all our content at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Rethinking Wellness. My guest today is author and pediatric surgeon Dana Seskind, who joins me to discuss her new book, Human Raised, Nurturing Connection, Curiosity, and Lifelong Learning in the Age of AI. We get into why true caring is what makes us unique from machines, how human parenting instills critical thinking and empathy and lots of other really important skills, the role of governments and regulators in dealing with AI harms, her hope framework for raising kids in the age of AI, and lots more. For paid subscribers, we do a deeper dive into the importance of so-called good enough parenting and how it compares to the gentle parenting and intensive parenting approaches. We also discuss my response as an eating disorder specialist to the comparison between AI and ultra-processed foods, which, spoiler alert, I am not a huge fan of, and I'll explain why. To hear the whole thing, plus get lots of other great perks, become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Paid subscribers get extended interviews, ad-free episodes, subscriber-only Q&As and essays, monthly office hours with me, commenting privileges, and more. Just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com to sign up or click the link in the show notes. And thanks so much to everyone who's already a paid subscriber. I could not do this work without you. And now, here's my conversation with Dana Seskind. Dana, welcome to Rethinking Wellness. I'm so excited to talk with you.
I am so excited to be here.
You've written a book that I found really helpful. I was telling you a little bit about it offline. It's called Human Raised. And I've been thinking a lot about AI and its intersections with wellness culture, you know, the culture of optimization, of trying to optimize everything about your body. And then also how we can think critically about AI in raising kids. And I have two young kids and, you know, I'm thinking a lot about like how to support their well-being and their development in an age of AI and, you know, technology even more broadly, sort of encroaching on childhood in so many ways. And so I have really been thinking about all of these topics in your book and found it really, really helpful. And so I'm excited to get into all that. But before we do, I'd love to hear a bit about your background and how you came to do the work that you do.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. So I'm actually a physician, a pediatric cochlear implant surgeon, to be exact. And people may say, well, why exactly is a pediatric physician, researcher, even talking about AI in early childhood? But actually, when I share my story, it makes complete sense. My life and my career has been dedicated to the power of human connection, the fact that talk and interaction in the early years literally wires a child's brain. Early in my career as an implant surgeon, I would implant two children who looked very much the same with the same technology, parents who loved them equally, and their outcomes were dramatically different. One would be speaking and, on par with their hearing peers, and the other, same time out, would barely be able to communicate. And it was that experience that pushed, you know, that led me down sort of this rabbit hole of the early childhood development, neuroscience, and which really led me to the fact that the power of human connection, talk and interaction, literally wires a child's brain. So the difference in the outcomes of my patients, I found out, had little to do with the technology or that their parents didn't love them equally, but the difference in the early language environment. And so for me, that sort of pushed me out of the operating room, although I still am very much a physician, into this research world of how can I allow all parents to understand the power of their talk and interaction to supporting their children's development. So much of my early work was about taking down barriers, whether it be from hearing loss or misconceptions about child development, to even policies and how policies can be better supportive of parents. Anyway, so that's my career. And then suddenly, with the age of AI, you know, suddenly we have this new technology that literally can mimic that human interaction that wires a child's brain. And I realized, oh my, we are at a potential turning point for humanity when we have technology that can actually potentially rewire a child's brain. And that was and at the same time, all of us, whether it be parents, policymakers, you know, myself as a physician, we have no policy guardrails, little science. And I realized that I needed to write this book so that we could have frameworks and a way to go forward for all of us.
It's so important. And I, you know, as a science journalist, I really hope that the science catches up quickly. I know we've started to see a few studies come out here and there, but, you know, this is such a new thing. AI has just been foisted on us really without our consent, I think. And I think it's important for researchers to start doing this work to see like the effects that AI is having on people's brains and relationships with kids and relationships with each other and ourselves and all of it. There's a really powerful passage in the introduction of your book. You write, "True caring, our capacity to have heartfelt thoughts about another being, rooted in concern for their flourishing, irrational in their intensity, is what makes us unique. It is the irreducible human core." That made me cry the first time I read it. I'm kind of tearing up now. It's really, really powerful. And I love that as sort of a grounding for this conversation we're going to have about raising kids in the age of AI, like care as what makes us human. Can you say more about that?
Yes, absolutely. I think about this question more than almost anything else I write about, because for a long time we've told ourselves that what makes us, you know, uniquely human is things like reason or language, creativity, or a tool use. And one by one, you know, AI has eroded our claim on each and every one of them. It reasons, or at least produces outputs that look like reasoning. It writes with fluency that surpasses, you know, some humans. It makes art, it makes poetry, it uses tools. But the truth is that no algorithm lies awake at night worrying about whether a child is struggling, you know, finally learns to read. No chatbot feels the weight, you know, of a human's unrealized potential. And while AI produces, you know, what looks like caring, but it really is pattern matching. It isn't caring. True caring, you know, our capacity to have heartfelt thoughts. I mean, that any parent understands, you know, that almost in irrational intensity, that is, you know, the irreducible human core of who we are. So, and it's ironically, I mean, I want to, you know, it sounds, oh, that's so nice, caring, but it's actually not incidental to our success as a species, right? It's actually the source of it, because, you know, and I can go down, I won't go down the science quite yet if you don't want me to, but human infants, because we're born so absurdly early and so helpless, you know, if we didn't have this incredible caring, this irrational, intense desire to protect our young, we probably as a human species wouldn't have survived. But, you know, that core, I think, is something that we need to remember and hold on to.
Can you say more about caring and what the science has to say about caring as both uniquely human and sort of central to our flourishing as a species?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it comes back to it's caring and connection. The fact that humans are born so early, you see, our brains are born, you know, we are born with brains only one third the size of adult brains. And that's why we're so helpless. But ironically, that, you know, being born too early is the origins of our human brilliance. Because, you know, after you're born, you have all this opportunity for brain growth. And in fact, in the first 3 years of life, 85% of the physical brain is being built. You know, a million new neural connections happen every second. And it is literally through human connection, the talk and interaction, that it's the instruction guide for the brain. But we wouldn't be receiving it, right, if we didn't have adults, specifically parents, with this, you know, intense primal desire to care and love and protect our young, because these human infants are so helpless. And so, ironically, this primitive drive, what Jeffrey Hinton actually called maternal instincts, but I call it parental instincts, it is the core of what has kept humanity alive and hopefully will be the guardrails as we go forward. Ironically, you know, this caring, if you will, Jeffrey Hinton, who's the godfather of AI, actually suggested that, you know, in talking about AI systems and our worry that they will, you know, they will lead to our destruction, actually said that we need to, you know, embed something akin to maternal or parental instincts into it, because that caring is, you know, so core to keeping humanity alive.
I really hope that AI does not figure out a way to embed those instincts, actually, because that, you know, because it is such a irreducible human thing. Like, yeah. What are we left with if they take that too, right?
But I want to push back. Even if they figured it out, humans, I am still not only pro-human, but I say that we need to protect that human connection, because even if it sort of looks like it and it's a facsimile, but sort of like ultra-processed food, it never is as good as the real thing.
Well, I want to talk about ultra-processed food bit, actually, because I'm a dietitian and I have some thoughts on sort of the nuances of that. And I have a lot of listeners who are disordered, you know, in recovery from disordered eating. So I think it's especially nuanced there. And also, like, my own child has some issues with food that it's been interesting to think about what we feed her and how it's different than what I sort of envisioned. But anyway, we'll talk more about that.
And just so you know, we have a family history as well. And ironically, my father is a nutritionist.
Oh, wow.
We don't have to go down that road.
We can have a whole other conversation, especially for my other podcast, which is about disordered eating specifically. So, yeah.
Oh, I can tell you stories. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I bet. So, yeah, getting back to AI and childhood for now, you write, you know, the good news is that deep face-to-face technology-free interactions between caregivers and children are the most effective way to give kids what I call the human edge. And you talk about the human edge as being this like set of skills, you know, social, emotional, cognitive skills that are going to matter most in an AI-driven world, but that I also think are really important for navigating diet culture and wellness culture. And, you know, the things we talk about here, like critical thinking, interpersonal connection, genuine creativity, empathy, and resilience, you know, navigating sort of all the pressures that are on us from this world of constant self-optimization and the pressures of all that. Can you explain how human parenting instills those capacities and sort of more about what the human edge is? And is there anything special that we have to do as parents to elicit those capacities, or is it a little more simple than we might think?
Yeah. You know, it was an amazing experience in writing this book and thinking about, you know, being at this incredible moment of like technological, quote unquote, advancement. You know, it's amazing what humans can create. And, you know, as I wrote this book, I realized this book isn't just about helping parents navigate and parent in the age of AI, but in some ways, we as parents are always parent. We need to understand what it means to parent for the age of AI. What are the skills that are going to help support, allow our children not to just survive, but thrive in this moment in time, especially when all the skills that we've been, quote unquote, optimizing our children for, those hard skills of, you know, knowledge, you know, science, math, you know, computation. It was almost like these machine-like skills we've been trying to optimize in our children. Now, all of a sudden, AI can, you know, do those skills at superhuman abilities. And it's not to say that children shouldn't still learn how to read and write and do math and all of these things, but those aren't going to be the big differentiators, because what is clear are those human, distinctly human skills that I'm going to explain, the human edge skills are going to be what are the differentiators, because what is scarce becomes more valuable. My husband's an economist, so forgive me. And those human skills like, you know, critical thinking, empathy, emotional intelligence, creativity, interpersonal connection, adaptability, resilience, those skills have often been called soft skills. Like they're not quite as, you know, as hard, but I would argue that they are the new quote unquote hard skills. And these skills, you know, ironically, are the very skills that are eroded by early unstructured exposure to AI. So the skills you're going to need are going to be eroded if you use AI too early, because they're built they can't be optimized. You know, as much as we want to be able to optimize them, you can't. They're built by, you know, things like critical thinking is built through the productive struggle, through failing and trying again. You know, when AI hands a child the answer, the workout actually never happens. You know, in that same way, you know, empathy is built by the friction of real relationships. The misunderstanding, you know, when a sibling, you know, takes away a toy, a conflict with a friend, the process of, you know, causing hurt and figuring out how to repair it, those are the ways that you build empathy. So when an AI companion offers the opposite, infinite patience, you know, agreeableness, you know, no rupture, there is no repair, no learning. So, you know, at some level, I think people are going to sell it. People who are producing these products are going to say, oh, look, this is appealing. But you're actually depriving a child from the crucial development. Even toys, you know, I've seen these new AI toy embedded toys like help build your child's creativity and curiosity. And they're handing them the playbook. But creativity is built by boredom. By handing your young child a paper box, a cardboard box, and they do all the thinking around how to make this into a toy. You know, I could go on and on, but, you know, none of this requires a curriculum. It requires resisting the urge to smooth every path, you know, because the best, you know, this was my favorite part. There are many favorite parts of understanding as I wrote this book, but the best preparation for an AI-saturated future is somewhat counterintuitively a thoroughly human-raised childhood, a low-tech childhood, if you will.
It's so interesting. And you talk in the book about how parents are sometimes, I mean, I feel this all the time, strapped for time, need something to occupy the kids while you're making dinner or, you know, whatever it is. And so these AI toys can be appealing in that way, right? Instead of plopping your kid in front of the TV, you're giving them something that seems to be interactive and maybe, you know, it's sold as or marketed as building connection or building creativity or whatever it might be. It's so appealing. I can see the seductiveness of it. Do you think, you know, this is something that's been on my mind lately because I've just been sort of at my wit's end, going back to work after maternity leave with no aftercare for my older daughter during the summer because it's camp and it's like shortened hours. And my husband just took a new job in the city, so he's not home when he used to be. So it's just like all on me, you know, kind of all day with the childcare. And there's been more TV. There's been more, you know, plunking the four-year-old in front of the TV and having her watch her favorite shows. And I'm like, you know, I think that that is better probably than giving her some sort of AI toy, which I will not allow into my home. Yes. Like that is very much not happening here. But, you know, I'm curious, you know, and your from your research, what the differences are there between something like, you know, traditional screen time versus these AI toys.
Yeah. And first of all, I want to start off by saying, give yourself grace. I mean, as a mom of now 8 children, you know, there are plenty of times I'm like, please, just go watch TV, go, you know, and we have to survive as well. And remember, it's not, you know, one moment that defines it. It's many multiple moments. And yes, it's, you know, in the content, I much prefer, you know, a PBS kids show than, you know, some of this AI slop that is actually, I call it toddler misinformation at a, you know, at an incredible scale. So yes, absolutely, you know, and give her also, you know, that cardboard box and let her, you know, go forth. I could go into a longer discussion, but, you know, what is the difference between screens and just regular television? I mean, one is obviously, what is the content? You can find on YouTube education, PBS Kids that you can find on TV as well, but then you can also find a lot of AI slop. But I think another important aspect that people don't realize is on these platforms, there is AI. Even if you're watching a video, how that video is served up to your child, the autoplay, which keeps the videos going and doesn't even give them a chance to stop on their own because it's overriding their own executive functions. So being thoughtful about, you know, what is the content, how much, but also giving yourself grace. I mean, trust me, my kids are now in their young 20s and I did all of those things and they're just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was also raised on, I mean, I've watched way more TV than my daughter ever will. And I'm, you know, for better or worse, right? I don't know if I think I turned out okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about your hope framework. I think that is really hopeful and a nice sort of takeaway from this book that I've been thinking about a lot since I read it.
Yeah. So, you know, what's really important is that I realized that you couldn't write a book that talked about all the different products out there because the products are always changing and evolving. And rather, I wanted to give a set of timeless principles that can help, you know, parents and all of us ground decisions about AI in the science of human development. Because even though, you know, you mentioned like, you know, some of this new science of AI and child development is new, and there is some, the science of human development, we have a lot of understanding. And so this hope framework is designed to sort of test, you know, stand the test of time because, you know, the technology can advance, but, you know, but how humans develop isn't. So hope is both an acronym and honestly a statement of values, because I think parents right now need to believe that the choices they're making in ordinary, exhausted moments actually matter. And let's face it, having a child is an act of hope that the future isn't fixed. And I really want parents to hear this. We are at the beginning of this. The decisions we make will have, you know, we are still in the driver's seat. So what is hope? H is for human connection is irreplaceable. It is a biologic necessity. Nothing builds the developing mind like real interaction. Full stop. Let's double down on it. Let's protect it. O is for own the imperfections. This is one of the thing that tends to surprise and relieve people most. Children don't thrive on perfect responsiveness. Stop being trying to be a perfect parent. Be a present parent. Be a real parent. Your children grow through mismatches and repairs. Imperfect, good enough parenting isn't a consolation prize. It's evolutionarily advantageous. So feel good about that. P is protect the early years. You know, those early years, you know, the first 8 years is when the brain is wiring the very circuits that will shape all future learning and relationships, especially the earliest period. Introducing AI during this specific window of time is a fundamentally different proposition than in an adolescent and an adult brain. I mean, I think we should be thinking about that period as well, but early is super important. And lastly is E is enhance, don't replace. The real question isn't whether AI is going to be in our child's lives. That genie is out of the bottle. You know, what is the role it's going to play is the real question. And I really urge parents, teachers, all of us to use tools that enhance their connection and interaction, not tools that replace those moments of connection. So hope isn't anti-AI. It's actually pro-childhood. And it gives parents something they can use in the moment, you know, a way to walk into any decision about technology and remind them what they're protecting and why.
Mm, that's so powerful. And I think about enhance, not replace, as like you have some anecdotes in the book about these AI companions that are being marketed to children. And, you know, this is like really out there. And it's wild to think about how quickly that came into the market. And some of these AI companions are sort of set up to like entertain the child, put the child to bed, you know, read a bedtime story, sing songs, like all these things that are typically the province of parents. And I get it, you know, if you have more than one kid and you're solo and stuff, it's like, it can be very tempting to think that there's something you can outsource that to that's not, you know, a childcare provider that you're having to pay and maybe not able to afford. So it is, I think, really important to think about those trade-offs and enhancing, not replacing, right? Like that seems like maybe a way that AI is not ever going to really be helpful. But what are some ways that you think AI could potentially enhance a relationship with a child or a child's learning that don't involve replacing the human connection?
Absolutely. And, you know, just to continue on with, you know, your last statement, my hope is that these people who build the tools, the people who are leading these AI companies, it's such an easy thing to say, oh, let me build something that replaces the human. Why not start thinking about how we can build these tools to actually allow us to be more present, to, you know, to take off all the invisible burdens? Because I think one of the most, you know, there are a lot of different potential ways that AI can support us and support our connections. You know, one that I'm incredibly excited about is thinking about how AI can lift all those invisible burdens, right? As a parent, you know that there are so many things that are pulling our attention, that are tapping our cognitive bandwidth. Everything from the logistics and meal planning to emailing back, you know, things at the school. And I think that as hopefully people start building tools that can be thinking about that more and more intentionally. Because when, you know, you mentioned, you know, the issues with childcare, I mean, that's a societal structural issue. You know, children were not meant to be just raised by one human. Yes, parents are the main provider of, you know, raising a child, but you know, there really was a village. How can AI lift invisible burdens so that we can start having more of that village feel? And so that's one thing. Two is, you know, I come from the medical field and I've seen how AI can, you know, allow us to better diagnose and understand differences. And I see tremendous opportunity about AI allowing us to better identify developmental, you know, learning differences early and providing, you know, very specialized support for that. I think that is huge because that right now we are missing the boat for so many kids. And look, I'm not at all, you know, it sounds like I'm sort of anti-interactive AI, but there are in science-driven ways where AI, like socially assistive robots, have been shown to help children with autism better learn social cues from, you know, in human interaction. So as long as these technologies are being built with the idea of we need to protect human connection, we need to support it, I think it's a great thing. And with science, I mean, you're a science journalist. I'm a researcher. I believe that, you know, marketing claims are one thing, real science is another. So,
right. We have to see what these things actually do. And I mean, I wish we could have randomized controlled trials before they even go to market, because I think the unintended consequences and the problems with them could be so on such a vast scale, depending on the rollout. And, you know, we've already seen that with things like ChatGPT and teen suicide and, you know, all of that, that there's some and medical misinformation as well. We're starting to see lawsuits coming out about that. But I just think there's so many potential harms to it that it would be really nice if there were some guardrails. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on regulation and sort of how we go about approaching that.
I think what you just said is incredibly important, but it's interesting that we almost say, oh, it would be really nice to have. Like, you know, imagine in the medical industry if, you know, medications, you know, were rolled out without actually understanding if they helped people and didn't have unintended consequences. No, of course.
The supplement industry does that, by the way.
You see, I don't know that as well, but it's wild to me. I mean, this technology is so powerful. It's akin to an artificial biologic, right? And why would we have a lower bar for something that can actually interact with our brain? The social media experiment on adolescents, I mean, that should give us a little bit of a wake-up call that these are not benign, invisible products. They're actually technologies that interact with our brain and that are being optimized by behavioral scientists in these companies. Let's make sure it's optimized for human flourishing, not excessive engagement and, you know, intimacy. So, but going back to, you know, the role of government, you know, I think, yes, there is. I think that it is happening. You know, we're just, you know, policymakers are just sort of catching up because, you know, everything is moving so incredibly fast. But I do want to, you know, remind the listeners, we don't sell a car seat without crash testing it. You know, we don't have pharmaceuticals that we give to kids without, you know, extensive safety testing. And right now with AI, the burden of proof is sort of backwards. You know, it's sort of like currently falls on the parents and researchers to say, oh, you know, let me show you the harms after the products already reached the homes. And I'd like to see that really reversed. Companies should have to demonstrate safety before a product reaches children, not after. I mean, you know, I know these plush toys with embedded LLMs look incredibly benign and you know, cute.
This is not Teddy Ruxpin.
This is not Teddy Ruxpin, who looks just so benign. It's more like the movie from Steven Spielberg, the teddy bear that really had a relationships. Because let's remember, relationships aren't just like a thing. That's how children learn. It's how they learn and how they learn to be human. So yeah, we need regulators to enforce safety standards. We need transparency. You know, we need transparency in labeling. Just like a parent can pick up a box of cereal and get an overview of what's in it, shouldn't they be able to pick up an AI toy and learn about the safety basics? That's independent, right? Not company funded. And, you know, I don't think that regulation and parental agency are intention. The truth is, individual investigation shouldn't be the only line of defense, right? It's an unfair fight, as my friend Rebecca Winthrop says it, because exhausted parenting, you're already, you know, you're a mother of two young children. Your cognitive bandwidth is tapped. And now you're being asked, you know, to try to go through and understand, is this safe for my child? It's just not fair. So, yeah.
My response usually is just don't allow it. You know, when in doubt, just keep it out. Like, I don't have Alexa. I don't have, you know, the kids are not anywhere on the internet. Their pictures are not there. I may still post a picture of my baby with an emoji over her face or whatever, but like, I haven't done even that, you know, like I'm very cautious about all that. And AI toys are just not happening. Like that's not coming in our house, you know, unless and until there is some major good quality research that shows some benefit, perhaps. But what I'm worried about is like schools, you know, when we get this push to have AI in schools, and that is coming from the Trump administration, and, you know, pressure from the AI industry is behind that, I'm sure. You know, that is not something that schools are necessarily consulting parents about. It's just happening. It's just rolling out. And I've heard stories about, you know, kids who had these Chromebooks that they were issued, which also wasn't really something that parents had consent in. And then suddenly Gemini was enabled on all these Chromebooks like overnight. And so these kids were exposed to large language models without any sort of guardrails, you know, without any understanding of how to navigate them or media literacy about like how to critically think about their responses. And that to me is just terrifying, the way that these things can just sort of infiltrate situations where the parents maybe aren't there or aren't able to vet the things coming in.
I couldn't agree more, but I do have a little bit more hope. Because I think this recent experience with social media, I think people's sort of antenna are up a little bit more than like right before, you know, all of the Chromebook issues. Cause I am hearing a lot more discussion. And I think there is a lot more happening at the state level, so I am hopeful. And I want parents to also feel empowered, right? There is the power of questions that can allow schools and teachers to know that you've got engaged parents. Because the truth is, these schools and teachers, they're trying to figure it out just like parents are. And, you know, some are going to like, you know, embrace it. Some are going to say none. But I think the power of, you know, I put in the book, you know, a list of questions that parents can, you know, in a non sort of aggressive way, ask their teachers in their schools, you know, things like, does your program have an AI policy for the year? You know, can I look at it? You know, what are the tools that are, you know, AI tools that are approved or prohibited, you know, and does it change by age? You know, how are you supporting teachers? I mean, teachers are just all of us, but in the school system, you know, we all need AI literacy, you know, from the earliest years. And, you know, and how do teachers think about it? I think if we approach them as partners, you know, especially in this moment, I think there's huge hope that we can help them navigate and, you know, be part of the committee to discuss these things. Everybody's figuring it out. But I'll tell you, like you, I'm a big believer in the precautionary. I'm a scientist. I do randomized controlled trials, large scale ones. But I can tell you, until you know, I believe strongly in the precautionary principle, because it's not like we don't know how to raise young humans. It's not like we don't understand how to help children learn to read and write and, you know, grow socioemotionally. As you say, show us the proof that this is going to, you know, be dramatically better than, you know, the farm-raised food, and we will consider so.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think about the precautionary principle with food a little differently. And I'm like, oh, I really apply it in my life as a parent and in other ways in my life very liberally. But then when it comes to food, I think I have such a more nuanced take on it from, if you know, this work I've done in eating disorders, which I think really is not like, as a general dietitian, when I was first trained in dietetics, I did not know anything about, did not think anything about, but then sort of realized, oh, I actually had my own eating disorder and I'm actually seeing disordered behaviors popping up in my clients and like, what's that about, and got training on it and, you know, just went sort of deep into this field. And so now it's like, I'm seeing with a whole different lens, but I do think that, you know, the precautionary principle with certain things is really important, but I think definitely in this regard where we just don't like, this AI stuff is so new, it's so counter to how we've been raising kids forever and what the research really says on, you know, the best ways to raise kids, that I think it's worth being extremely cautious. And that ties into something that I want to talk about now in sort of a deeper dive for paid subscribers, which is good enough parenting. I think that is a really huge, you know, that's a part of your HOPE framework, really. It's the idea that we have to sort of like own the imperfections and allow ourselves to be messy and to rupture and repair, and why that's so good for kids. And I think, you know, there are a lot of us who are recovering perfectionists in this, listening to this, right? And I definitely myself am a recovering perfectionist and sometimes still fall into that trap. So I really want to sort of dig into that research and why actually imperfect parenting is so good. And I also want to get into the ultra processed food nuances as well, because I think that's really fascinating. So first, before we dive into all that stuff, to wrap up the free portion of the episode, can you tell listeners where they can find you and learn more about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find Human Raised and a bit about this work on humanraised.org. And, you know, obviously the book is sold in all the usual bookstores, but on the website humanraised.org, there are some downloadable frameworks that you can start thinking about.
Awesome. We'll put links to that in the show notes too, so people can find everything. So now let's dive in a little bit to the good enough parenting piece. Why do you think good enough parenting is so important? And why is trying to optimize parenting actually counterproductive? You've been listening to a free version of this episode. To hear the rest, upgrade to paid at rethinkingwellness.substack.com.